Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Materials Universe podcast. This is your host, Bailey Tibbett, and I'm here today with Dr. Wenny Wong, who's an assistant professor in the Maqueda Department of Chemical Engineering at UT Austin, and she is a recipient of the Maria Gepper Mayer Award in 2025. Welcome, Dr. Wong. We're so excited to have you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And as always, my name is Audrey. I'm the producer here at the Materials Universe, and I'll be joining everyone today.
Sweet. So I guess to start, I wanted to ask about maybe just give us like a brief overview of your research as it pertains to our Mercek Center.
Yeah, so I run a computational group. We specialize in atomistic simulations of materials, specifically in semiconductors. And in particular, we focus a lot on defects in semiconductors and how we can modulate materials properties based off of their defect properties. And so we've been exploring that with the Mercek using low-dimensional materials, which you can think of as kind of the ultimate surface that you can engineer. And it turns out that there are certain very useful defects that we can utilize for energy-efficient computing applications, or that we think is useful for those applications.
Wow, that's really cool. I remember when I did like microfabrication once for like a REU, defects were the bane of our existence. So it's cool that they can be useful a little bit. I did not know that.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a double-edged sword. So there's certainly defects you don't want in your system because they can kind of zap away the electronic properties that you're looking for. But in some cases, they can be very beneficial. So maybe the classic example of that is doping in silicon. It gives you sort of this controlled room temperature conductivity that's essentially the basis of all transistors.
Would you mind expanding on what defects in these materials look like?
Yeah, so it turns out that a lot of materials in nature like to take on the crystalline form. So the atoms or molecules are arranged in a very regular pattern. And this we consider sort of a perfect crystal. And the physics of that has been pretty well known, I would say, since like the 1930s or 40s. And you can think of defects as sort of a deviation from that. So let's say you have a lattice of silicon. You might be missing a silicon atom where you would expect it to be. We would consider that, for instance, a vacancy defect. And then it can get more complicated from there. You can have impurities in the lattice, and they can sit on top of the silicon site or somewhere else in the crystal. And then there's even more complicated defects like grain boundaries and line dislocations, for instance.
Cool. Can you, are you working with materials that already have these defects, or can you force these defects into the materials?
Yeah, so I think it can go both ways. So actually, it turns out that thermodynamically, at any finite temperature, your material will always have a defect. And you can show that pretty rigorously. And so what that means is that oftentimes the properties that we do measure, it's often of a defective material. But of course, there are certain situations where you want the defect inside. And there are lots of techniques that very talented experimentalists are able to use to do that in a controlled manner.
Oh, that's really cool. I think you might be the first computationalist, I want to say, that we've had on the podcast. And so I guess like when I think about, you know, semiconductor fabrication and whatnot, or just like maybe STEM stuff outside of computer science, of course, I think of like the experimentalist side of things, like wet lab, like beakers and pipettes and whatnot. So can you kind of like briefly explain a little bit kind of about like what a computational lab does?
Sure. Yeah. So I would say, you know, our bread and butter is sort of simulations. And we run simulations that typically involve a supercomputer. And what that means is, you know, you're probably familiar with your laptop, which has maybe 4 to 8 processors on it. So if you compare that to a supercomputer, a single node has maybe on the order of 64 to 128 processors. So it's several times more powerful than a work desktop or a laptop. And then a supercomputing cluster is like on the order of several thousands of these nodes. And so you can imagine kind of the types of simulations that you can run to almost kind of arbitrary complexity if you have enough of the resources. So our type of simulation, I would say, falls under the atomistic simulation. So we worry a lot about, you know, how atoms are bonded to each other, how they're interacting with each other, what's happening with the electrons. Are they moving around in the material? Are they trapped in the material? And then how does that affect things like the current that you expect to see in the measurements or the optical properties if you were to excite it with a laser, for instance? And so what's really exciting, I think, about these sort of calculations is that we operate sort of in the realm of what's called first principles calculations, which in principle don't require experiment, but in practice often does involve experiment of some sort. And it's really exciting because it offers the potential to really predict materials properties from constitutive equations, so very fundamental equations. And I think the power to do that is very enticing in terms of materials engineering.
Sorry, I need to sit in that for a second.
No problem.
I guess I do have a follow-up question. So you mentioned it's kind of like a first principles sort of ordeal, the computation. So does that mean that your lab also does a lot of theory?
Yeah, so I would say we do a little bit of theory. Right now, we're very much computationally oriented. But to understand the simulation, you want to be able to understand the theory, like what exactly the numbers that are coming out of the simulation mean. And is something that we always ask, which is this something real that we're simulating at the end of the day? Or what can sometimes happen like an artifact of the way we've set up the calculation? And so we're always sort of kind of thinking about, you know, can we understand this fundamentally? And then also, can someone observe this using a measurement of some sort?
Previously, you've emphasized balancing that kind of theoretical understanding with the practical applications. How do you approach that balance in your group's research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I sort of see it as a feedback loop in a sense. So you need the fundamentals to really pull through to the applications, but simultaneously the applications inform the fundamentals sometimes. So a really, I would say, classic example of that was how the field of thermodynamics started. It was very much motivated by the fact that people wanted to build steam engines and they needed to figure out what was going on with that. The field that we're in, which is very much related to condensed matter, solid state physics, sort of had the opposite trend where people were very interested on what was happening in the fundamental spectra of hydrogen. So if you look at the optical spectra, you'll see very discrete lines. And at the time, that was extremely confusing because all of our classical models told us that energy is continuous. And here we were seeing this discrete spectra for one of the most basic materials, which is hydrogen. And so I think a lot of quantum mechanics really came out of studying kind of these basic questions of things that kind of that people were observing, but couldn't really explain with the theories at the time.
It's always back to thermo.
It's always back to thermo.
We've had like this constant string of just talking about equilibrium states, partially because of the IRG topic and also just partially because that's how a lot of the professors we interview kind of center their research. Like when they try to explain it, they really talk about like the equilibrium of the body or like a system or something like that. So
we really need
always back to thermo.
We need to rebrand to the equilibrium universe.
Or far from
the thermo
universe.
Yeah.
It's fascinating how it all comes back to trying to find balance in a system. Are there any other areas of your research where y'all are trying to find that kind of balance in a system?
Yeah, I feel like that's a very central part of a lot of material science and engineering, which is sort of balancing these trade-offs. So we focus a lot on electronic and optical properties of materials. And if you look at kind of what's in the industry, it's very different from what we understand theoretically. So right now, silicon is kind of king, the king material in a lot of electronics. And it isn't because it's the best from a conductivity standpoint, or even in a general material standpoint. But there are other factors that really drive silicon to the forefront. So it's very abundant. Most of our infrastructure is around making silicon very high purity. But if you were to choose from purely like a material standpoint, there are lots of other what we call group four materials. So materials that look very chemically similar to silicon, but have much better electronic properties. So one example of that would be like gallium. Which sits very close to silicon. But gallium is a lot more expensive, a little bit harder to process, and doesn't have quite the same doping ability, so ability to incorporate defects. So I think a lot of the engineering side is really about balancing what you think is the best material in one sense versus what actually is practical at the end of the day.
So I guess when you simulate like these interactions, do you typically work with like the model material of silicon, or do you like change a little bit to like maybe like gallium arsenide or something like that?
Yeah, so it'll depend. So there are, I would say maybe in our field, there are maybe like a handful of materials that I would say the field really knows very well. So we operate in the area of like oxides and nitrides, which cover semiconductors and insulators. And what's nice about those is that first, they have a lot of interesting physics and chemistry that's involved. And also they have probably some pretty niche applications that silicon isn't quite good at covering. And so when we think about new materials, we often have to go back to how we understand silicon to see like, okay, is this a good sanity check for what we're looking for? And then we try to say, okay, now that we have this understanding of this maybe one method on silicon, can we apply it to this new material? Is the physics and chemistry similar at all, or is it something completely different?
Something you said earlier about the kind of equilibrium of all materials was really fascinating to me, because it reminded me of you had talked about like the give and take kind of these materials. And it made me think about how, like, in a more basic analogy, like if we make a material like harder, for example, it often becomes more brittle. Mm-hmm. Are there any other examples like that in your work where you've seen a material's properties change, and how do you find that balance, I guess?
Yeah, maybe another example I can give is in solar cells. So you can kind of imagine if you were designing a solar cell material, kind of that first stage of a list of ideal material properties. So if it's a solar cell, you obviously want it to absorb as much sunlight as possible. And so there's this one very basic material parameter called the band gap. It defines an energy gap with which you can excite an electron from the occupied states to the unoccupied states. And so you would imagine that if I wanted to capture as much sunlight as possible, I'd want that band gap to be very, very small, right? I can get as much of the solar spectrum as I possibly can. But it turns out that such kinds of small band gap materials oftentimes don't have the best transport properties. So you've successfully kind of excited and absorbed the solar sunlight, but then you can't convert it very efficiently to current. So there's actually a very optimal balance of that. And that has a well-known relationship, actually, in that particular field called the Shockley-Queisser limit. And so they've computed like what explicitly this trade-off is. And so a lot of the search for new materials is often kind of building on top of that. You know, can we find often these conflicting materials requirements for an overall complex process, like deriving energy from the sunlight?
I guess this kind of goes into your path as becoming a professor and kind of just like career history in general. But are there any other instances? I know we keep asking you for examples of this, but are there any other instances of like a kind of trade-off that you've observed in your research in different areas?
Yeah, I think I often also get this question a lot from my students, which is there's a lot in the literature right now that you have to kind of catch up to get to a point where you feel like you understand the field. And especially now, kind of the rate at which papers are coming out, it can be pretty overwhelming. And so, you know, everyone has a very finite amount of time and energy in the day. And so inevitably, you have to prioritize what you want to focus on. And so that, I think, is really a fundamental trade-off in research. So there's so many things that I personally want to learn. But, you know, there's deadlines and all sorts of things that have to counterbalance that. And so the way I at least tell my students how to think of it when they're kind of building out their research expertise is to sort of think of their knowledge base as like a pie shape. So you try to read very broadly in many areas, but it's not super detailed. But there's like one or two things that you just know very, very well. And hopefully they're orthogonal to each other in some way, or they complement each other. And for us, that often looks like knowing something very technically in detail, and then maybe also adding like scientific programming to the mix.
Well, speaking of, you have a large variety of types of lab experiences in your career. From my research, you'd worked in aerospace at one point, as well as behavioral neuroscience. Do you pull from those experiences in your work, either in the research side of things or with your group?
Yeah, I think that's more because I'm a very indecisive person. <It's the same. laughs> more than anything. But, you know, I'm really glad that I did that, I guess, with the benefit of retrospection, because I think I was very naive as an undergrad, so I didn't quite really understand what research was. And it was definitely a process that required a lot of trial and error. And I think that was really important because things that look very cool at the surface can often give you very different day-to-day experience. And now I can say, like, I found something that matches the type of person that I am. And, you know, for example, that neuroscience lab, I can give an example for that. I thought I was going to be, at one point, a neuroscientist, but also, like, an electrical engineer or something like that. And so I joined this lab. A lot of it was sort of annotating behaviors of videos of mice. So that's what I started with, and that was fine. And then they were happy with that work, and so they were like, okay, now you can join the lab and actually do the experiments. And that sounded really cool, right? Except they brought me into the lab, and they were like, okay, we're a neuroscience lab. We have to surgically attach contacts to the mouse's brain, but it's not like in vivo or anything. So the mice dies in the process, and they essentially have to euthanize the mouse in order to do that. And I discovered I couldn't do that. Yeah. Just like from a personality standpoint, I'm glad there are people who do that because it's very important research. But it was definitely something that I wouldn't have known without trying it.
I'm with you. I had a lab partner in physics whose main research was studying like muscle development, and a lot of it had to do with removing muscles from mice. And she would tell me about her work, and it was interesting, but I couldn't go much beyond listening to it.
See, I hear this, and I'm like, wow, that's so cool. I really should have been a doctor.
alternate career path. Yeah.
Well, I get kind of close. Do mostly like biology type work now, so I do get to throw away my bacteria, I guess. But it's not quite the same.
You are very much a biochem nerd.
Yeah, I've become a biochem nerd for sure. I definitely relate to like having not started that way for sure. I think in undergrad, especially, I was also very indecisive. So I just like jumped from different labs. And so I've done like nuclear forensics, like just like traditional biology and material science and stuff. And I definitely think that like, I think in general, people think that science is very narrow. Or things that's like, oh, only one type of person will probably enjoy doing research or enjoy doing science. But from what I've understood, it's actually like, it's like you said, it really depends on kind of the field, what you're researching. And like, I think a lot of different types of people could actually find themselves in a lab that they maybe wouldn't traditionally consider just because it does match their personality so well or their lifestyle.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, a nice way to think about that is we're on like the spectrum of fundamental to applied. So we're definitely very much on the fundamental side of things. But, you know, kind of figuring out how to scale that up industrially into an actual product is also like a whole thing in and of itself as well.
Is there any, this is kind of off the cuff, is there any kind of pressure in being in a chemical engineering field versus just a chemistry?
Yeah, I haven't really felt any pressure to do. I will say we don't quite do, I think, what's typically considered chemical engineering in the sense of like reaction engineering and like process flow diagrams. Although I am teaching a class this semester exactly on that. So I think I can say I've maybe officially become a chemical engineer now. I think, you know, I think that's really one really great thing about UT Austin and then the department that I'm in is they've really allowed sort of whatever research ideas come to mind to really kind of develop on their own. And so actually, since coming here, we've gone in lots of directions that I wouldn't have anticipated when I just started. And so that's been really rewarding, being able to be in an environment where there's just so many people that can introduce you to so many ideas that you've maybe not come across before.
Yeah, I think when people hear chemical engineering, they think that you do either really intense chemistry or you only do oil. So it's like, oh, the only element you know is carbon. And I always have to be like, actually, I know two more elements, nitrogen and oxygen and maybe sulfur.
Actually, I thought all chemists and chemical engineers were working with plastics.
No, that's you're fair.
I also get that for material science.
Yeah. I just, everyone I'd talked to about material science before working here had talked to me about plastics. But I grew up in the plastics industry, so it's just...
That's fair. That's fair. Actually, that would not be an unreasonable perception of materials at that point. Yeah.
I guess, like, in finding kind of your place along that spectrum, was that something that you felt like you had to do alone, or did you have, like, any outside help from maybe, like, mentors guiding you or any experiences that, like, really shaped, like, and helped point you to where you wanted to be?
Yeah, I think it's really a combination of all three. So, like, trying lots of different things out, talking to people, kind of figuring out what their experience is like, and to a certain extent, just trying it out for yourself. So actually that aerospace lab that I joined earlier, I'm really grateful for because I had a really fantastic grad student mentor, and she really involved me in sort of all the steps of the lab, all the way down to like purchasing glycerol for the lab or lab gloves or whatnot. And so I think being able to see that really sort of opened my perception of like what happens at a university. I also discovered that I have a tendency to break things in the lab as well. Fortunately, the project itself was about fracture, so it kind of folded in pretty well in that sense. But I also kind of found myself thinking, like, why is it exactly fracturing in this way? And so from there, I was like, well, I kind of see this thing about computation, so maybe I'll try it. And I was fortunate to get an internship actually to a German company, and they were willing to entertain someone who's never done computation before, which is really nice. And I really liked it. I liked the ability to kind of see very specific relationships between variables and then how that can be used to predict something physical in the world. And I really, you know, I would say that's kind of the underlying philosophy for why I'm so excited about computation is, you know, you really can understand, you know, what's really happening in the material and then like connecting it to the real world is another really interesting challenge.
I wanted to go back to the kind of mentorship thing. Is there a piece of advice or any kind of guidance you'd be interested in sharing from like your history of working with mentors or working as a mentor?
Yeah. I would say the biggest thing was learning that having lots of mentors can be very helpful. I think with the benefit of retrospection, I can say that kind of at each stage of education, I had a really fantastic mentor. And it wasn't always necessarily academic. A lot of it was sort of getting me out of my very introverted shell into the world. And so I would say kind of at each stage of education, I always had at least one person that I think really shaped my career path. And a lot of it was sort of, I think, opening a door that I didn't know to look for. So like telling me about a program or saying that, oh, you should apply for this thing and see what happens. And I think those like little pieces of advice really accumulate and really kind of help push the arrow, so to say, in one direction versus another. And so I think the biggest thing is to sort of try to look out for those people. So it really depends on who you interact with. And some of it's, I think, very dependent on the personality of the mentor and mentee. And then some of it is sort of kind of looking at as much information as you can. So I think I tend to hoard information. But I think that's been really helpful because you can kind of see what options you have. And maybe that also is related to my general indecisiveness. But, you know, yeah, yeah.
That reminds me of an anecdote a quote I learned a long time, I heard a long time ago. I cannot remember if it was from a book or like a movie or a video or something, but someone told me to look for the helpers. Mm-hmm. Because you'll just always, going through life, you're always going to find people who want to help you or help the people around you. And it can only benefit you and the people around you if you're looking for them and then actively working to become one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think you can kind of tell, and some of it's a little bit experience driven. But for sure, I think I can always remember sort of like a critical point in the mentorship, each mentorship stage, that I'm like, okay, that was the point that I think really kind of changed things in the end.
Yeah, I have like really bad eyesight. So I always just tell people that my eyesight's only ever 20/20 in hindsight because it's not going to get 20/20 otherwise. So I definitely get that. Like looking back, it's almost like you can divide up everything into like little chapters or subsections of your life. I'm like, this person was very important then. So that's really cool. I guess, do you do anything like within your group to kind of like keep this legacy going on and continue like paying this helpfulness forward?
Yeah, so we're really big on outreach, educational outreach, and I try to at least get all of my group members involved at least once a year, if not more. And I think it's, of course, it's, you know, beneficial from like the outreach part to the general community, but I also think it's mutually beneficial from a research standpoint as well, because you really don't learn anything until you have to teach it to someone else, because that's where you really start to see gaps in your knowledge. And it's always surprising kind of the questions that you get. I think some of the most interesting questions I get are from people who have, you know, little to no knowledge of the field. They're just kind of generally curious about something. And I think that, you know, it really helps invigorate me to be like, oh, okay, I hadn't thought of it in that way. But yeah, I guess you could think of it in that way. And I think overall, when I think back to kind of all those little tiny points in time of, you know, something that really changed the overall trajectory of things, I think it's important to, you know, provide, now that I'm in a position to do that, to provide also maybe a critical point for someone at some point in the future, because we really don't know what that looks like for each person. And so the more ways we can provide it, the better.
Versec has like this like girls STEM day event where we always invite like basically just like kids and students of all ages and genders to come to the university and do like these small little science workshops as like part of outreach. And I just remember, I think the last one I was like showing the kids how to do little microscope stuff, like very basic, like those like $30 microscopes you can get on Amazon, just showing them slides of like bug wings and stuff. And so in my head, I was like, I got this. That's easy. But then sometimes, like every once in a while, one of the kids would ask a question and I'd just be like, I have no idea how to answer this. cells. Like, I guess I actually don't know that much about cells.
We love working with Girl Day. I think having less knowledge sometimes means that there are less like boundaries and barriers that are like in your mind. And so you're making a lot of connections that are often blocked by people who have a lot of the foundational knowledge. And so I honestly think to continue innovating and like working in research, we need to continue having these conversations with people outside our professions, because sometimes they can see the connections that we are just a little too good to make.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you were a part of the UChicago MRSAC as well. Can you tell us about that? Did you do outreach with them at all, or what were your experiences over there?
Yeah, yeah. So I was very fortunate to be part of that particular MRSAC. What I really found was special was we were able to hold a weekly colloquium with a local high school class. So we partnered with a local physics teacher, and they had this really interesting class schedule where like Wednesdays was sort of like this free period for them to explore, which was very, I feel like, very unique. And so they invited us. It was me and a couple other grad students, and we basically had free reign to talk about whatever we wanted. And maybe for some of the classes, we maybe got a little bit too excited, and it was like stuff that you don't quite learn until maybe your third or fourth year in college. But it was a lot of fun because you get to see the same people on a more regular basis, and that was, I felt like, really fulfilling, because then you kind of see how they develop, at least for that semester. And so it's something that I've been thinking a lot more recently in terms of how to measure impact of all of these activities, and how do we best kind of utilize those sorts of resources and build those sorts of relationships.
It's definitely interesting to attempt to measure impact on that kind of scale, because with the MRSAC outreach in particular, I always tell our volunteers and our educational facilitators that we're not doing what we do. We're not doing our outreach to have that student walk out and be able to define any of the scientific terms we're talking to them about. We're doing it so that they have a positive experience with science. And so, you know, and that brings up the question, how do you measure joy or play? And so we do our best, and we actually do attempt to measure it, but it is less about the kind of hard skills and more about the like the soft side of it and the fun that you can have and creating those lasting memories that will hopefully follow them into their future.
For sure.
When I try to convince fellow grad students to do outreach, I just always tell them, like, do you remember that joy you had way back when?
Yeah.
When you thought about science? Would you like to feel that again? And like that kind of thing, because at least for me personally, you know, it's definitely one of those things where sometimes you just get so bogged down in the research or like some failed experiment because you didn't sing to your bacteria that night or something so ridiculous, and it doesn't feel scientific at all. And then it's just like another thing to kind of go and work with people who are just so energetic and so excited about whatever you're doing. And you could literally, like, in your head, you're like, I'm just showing them how to make salt water. But they think it is, like, the coolest thing ever. And it's just, it's so hard to not catch that, you know, and also be like, yeah, this is actually the coolest thing ever.
Yes, I agree.
As scientists, do y'all find it invigorating? like, does it help kind of bring energy and passion into your research?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Bailey captured it perfectly. We're like, because, you know, not everything is going perfectly all the time. No. There's always something that is like not working or you just can't figure it out. And kind of taking a pause and really kind of looking back and engaging with people outside, I think it's really easy to otherwise get tunnel vision and not really try to see a bigger picture. So those are always really nice to be like, this is actually really cool, actually. Like, why can we do this, actually? Yeah.
There's so many, like, really wonderful, simple things that we experience every day that are really cool phenomena when you know, when you just blow them up to something that's bigger, like, I don't know, elephant toothpaste is a really great example.
Yes. Toothpaste?
Elephant toothpaste?
Elephant toothpaste?
It's a soap. Well, so you use soap to, it's basically an, explosive's the wrong word. It's an intense reaction that you put in soap, essentially like soapy water, and it creates this column of, it's not actually toothpaste, but it looks like a big tube of toothpaste or like a big cylinder of toothpaste coming out of the beaker.
Oh, like those like glowy worm things for fireworks.
Kind of, but this is more of like a liquid, and it's and it explodes, and it kind of looks like the size of toothpaste an elephant would use for its tusks, I think is where the name came from.
Okay.
And I know yeast's involved. It's been a long time since I've done it, but you can do it on these really grand scales and talk about the kind of intense reactions you can get out of things you can find in your kitchen. I'd love to take a moment to talk about one of your recent achievements because I thought it was really cool.
Oh, okay.
I was wondering if you could tell us more about the Maria Gopert Meyer Award that you were recently awarded.
Sure. Yeah, it was a really great honor to receive. So it's given by the American Physical Society, APS, and it's given the general citation is like some kind of research contribution for a early career woman in physics. And so I think you're probably referring to the citation,
yeah.
Which was, I think, a lot longer than what I had submitted originally. So I think the selection committee, of course, you know, looked at the research and thought it was pretty interesting enough, but then also highlighted the sort of advocacy components that were also related. And I think, so in particular, I think the past couple of years I've been much more involved with APS leadership. So I was a member and then also the chair of the Forum for Early Career Scientists. So we were thinking a lot about how do we promote early career scientists, especially when there are so many tumultuous things going on the outside. And then how do we bring that to the APS community, which has kind of a really big meeting in March and used to be in April, but now it's kind of combined into one conference.
So I never seriously went into research, but when I was in my undergrad, I got the free membership to the American Physical Society as a physics student. And even though I did some research, but I wasn't doing a ton, it still made me feel really included in like a scientist because I would get the, I don't know if it's quarterly, but like the magazine. And I just loved reading all of the like, you know, the new stuff happening in the physics community. And it really made me feel kind of like, I don't know, special in a way. And like going to the conferences, it was just it was really impactful on me as like a young physicist in undergrad. So I've always been really appreciative.
I mean, that's really great to hear because I think APS has really tried to ramp up kind of the support for younger physicists, especially kind of keeping an eye because, you know, physics wasn't exactly the most well-represented field of science. And so, yeah, no, that's really great to hear because I think, especially with, like, the Career Mentors Fellow, which I've been fortunate to be a part of for the last couple of years, a lot of it's, like, really kind of bridging that gap that where we often lose people and interest from, like, the high school to undergrad and then undergrad to graduate school.
That was something I investigated in college a little bit, but I was more focused on the elementary, middle to high school pipeline of where we kind of lose physics because I experienced a lot of anxiety surrounding physics in high school. I was fine with chemistry, biology, whatever, but for some reason I held a lot of anxiety around physics.
Me too. Yeah. I think it's always, it definitely is very different for lots of people. Sometimes there are lots of external factors that are, you know, may or may not be in your control, and then a lot of times internal ones. So I've also kind of had a similar experience, especially in my first year of college. So I actually almost failed my physics class going into college, and that was a really big adjustment in the end. And so I think, you know, having those sort of community resources to kind of, you know, get you out of the potential tunnel vision can maybe hopefully help a lot of people along the way. Yeah.
Yeah, I think something that helps too is kind of having non-STEM things that you like and enjoy to do, you know? We talk about it all the time about how, like, as important as we think STEM is, you know, we also think it's important to focus on other things too, you know, like humanities, art, hobbies, that kind of thing. Are there any, like, hobbies or any subjects that interest you that aren't STEM-related that you've found have, like, helped keep you sane throughout the years?
I'm particularly curious about your pottery.
Oh, my pottery. Yeah, I think, you know, I think being a good scientist also should be equivalent to being a good person. And so, you know, that's probably shaped a lot by my educational background, which was very much about being a well-rounded person. So I went through like the IB or International Baccalaureate program. And a lot of that training was, yeah, you want to do the STEM, like the heavy math and science, but you also, you know, what do you know about the theory of knowledge, for instance? But actually, I think that was very useful because I think it helps you think less mechanically about things and more holistically. So because, you know, I think we do mostly computer simulations, I try to get away from the computer as much as I can. And I actually really like making things with my hands. And so, yeah, pottery has been one of those. And that's always been really nice because I think the process for thinking about it is almost very experimental because you're trying different things. You're seeing how different, like, firing conditions are affecting the glaze, for instance, or, you know, you're trying a new shape and unfortunately everything cracks because you didn't properly smooth everything out. And so that I think has been really nice to get something kind of tangible at the end of the day.
Yeah. There's a lot of chemistry in pottery.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts about doing not science is slowly discovering how much science there is. It's like you never really get away from it.
It slowly seeps in. Almost unintentionally.
Yeah, I think I was watching some video on color theory and I was like, oh, wow, this is just math and physics.
Yeah.
But like, it's like one of the coolest applications of math and physics. So.
Yeah.
And I can't draw to save my life. So we like to finish with our theme for this season of the podcast. So the theme for this season is kind of just asking about any materials or chemistries or anything that you're really excited about and you think can be like the new frontier for material science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've been really excited about our MRSEC work. So I talked a little bit about it at the beginning. And what makes me really excited is that we think we have models that kind of connect us from the material science to something that you can probably observe at the device level. And you can imagine there's lots of like steps in between that can potentially affect that. But the model itself is surprisingly really simple. And as like a computational / pseudo theory person, that's really satisfying. You're like, yes, it's so simple that it can maybe explain lots of things. And so I'm hoping that we can eventually test that model with an actual system and to see if, you know, is it as simple as we think it is, which it probably isn't. But, you know, can we explain some of the things that we're seeing? So, for example, I think we're really interested in energy efficient computing. And what I mean by that is if you think about kind of the carbon footprint of our current computing resources, it's pretty big. You know, the energy that it takes to run a data center is like on the average of a small town electricity consumption. And we're getting more and more of these data centers. ChatGPT is becoming more regular. So the footprint of computation is having a much bigger footprint. And kind of this energy efficient computing has a way to do that. And then also simultaneously sort of change the way that people think about architecture of computing. So right now, most computing, you've got your CPU and your memory, and you've got to shuttle data back and forth. And this actually turns out to be about 30% of the power consumption of your computer, and also a really slow part. It's often the bottleneck. So our CPUs are much, much faster than the thing connecting the memory and the CPU.
I think we talked about this with Dr. Nkorvia.
That's right. That's okay. Right. Yeah, so she, I think, gave a really excellent introduction to that. So we're very much on the materials, material side on things, and we're actually talking to her to
Wonderful.
See if we can...
I love that.
Yeah, get to the more device side of things. Yeah.
Well, thank you for helping me make that connection.
Yes, yes.
I love that.
Yes, thank you for talking with us. We've loved having you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin, and an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.